We're so very pleased to be here today, November 12th, 2024, to speak with the Honorable Jean Harrison Clements, currently a senior judge on the Court of Appeals of Virginia. So, Judge Clements, we're going to hopefully talk about your life today and your judicial career. So we'll start right off with some background information.
That'll be fine.
Tell me where and when you were born.
I was born on March 31, 1938 in Front Royal, Virginia. That's in Warren County.
Okay. And did you grow up in Front Royal, or did your family live other places as well?
They lived in Hagerstown when I was very young and during the war, because my father went to work for Fairchild Aircraft in Hagerstown, Maryland. But we came back to Front Royal just as I entered the second grade, and I continued to live in Front Royal until I graduated from Warren County High School in 1956. I think the day after I graduated, my father had built a home in right outside of Harrisonburg, and so off the family went.
Everybody
to live
moved
in
to
Harrisonburg.
Harrisonburg. So tell me a little bit more about your parents. Who were they? You can tell me their names, and did you have any siblings?
I have no siblings. I was an only child of two only children, and so we were a relatively small family. The side of the family that I know most about is the Harrison side, and when you introduced me, you introduced my professional name, and I have kept my maiden name Harrison, because that's a very Virginia family name, and I'm very proud of it. But I'm the last in our line since my parents had no sons. But the Harrison family had two branches, the James River branch, of which we were not a part, and the Shenandoah Valley branch, of which we are a part. And our side of the Harrison family came from England originally in 1666, from Durham, England, and first came to New York, Oyster Bay, New York. And it was then in the early 1700s that they moved from that area and eventually settled in Rockingham County. I believe my father said that there were four brothers, and they settled in each section of Rockingham County, and my particular family settled in what is known as Melrose, and that is in the northeast section of Rockingham County. So I know the most about the Harrisons. My mother was a Samsel, and that family primarily lived and came to Stephen City. I really don't know a whole lot of the history beyond that with them. As I said, most of the research in our family was done with the Harrisons. But then also on my mother's side were the Ballard family, and they came primarily from the Fauquier area, Marshall. And so that's what I know about some of our family history.
And your parents' names again?
My mother's name was Frances Marion Somsell, and my father was Truman Theodore Harrison. And it's just interesting that my father's grandfather was Turner Ashby Harrison, and his father was James Knox Polk Harrison. And unfortunately, I don't have any information to tell me how it was that with no relationship to our family, I have one Harrison, James Knox Polk Harrison, no relationship whatsoever that I can determine, and Turner Ashby Harrison. Although Turner Ashby was an officer in the Confederate Army under Jackson's command, and actually was killed in battle at the Battle of Harrisonburg. So I suspect that there must have been some affinity, no relationship that I know of, but some affinity for him that might explain that.
And then the familiarity with the name.
Yes, perhaps so, yeah.
And so tell me about going to school. You went to high school
I did.
In
Front Royal.
Front Royal.
Graduated from Warren County High School in 1956, and then spent 3 years at then Madison College as a day student because, as I said, my family, the day after I graduated from high school, moved to Harrisonburg in Rockingham County, and spent 3 years there, and then went to the University of Virginia Law School, where I graduated in 1962.
Now, when you were in college at Madison,
yep.
At the time, I recall, the college, one of their fortes was essentially teaching people to be teachers.
Right.
So education was a strong part of the curriculum.
Right.
Did you go there with one idea about what you were going to do after college? Did you change your mind, or did you always know that you were going to go to law school?
I always knew that I wanted to go to law school.
Okay.
There were no lawyers in my family, however. And when I was in high school in those days, for women, girls, it was mostly teaching, nursing, being a clerk in store, being a homemaker, and a secretary. And I just didn't want to do any of those. So I had a great affinity for studying history like that, and that's how I pursued my idea. When we moved back to Harrisonburg, I was a day student at Madison College. My family were a very middle-class family. We did not have a lot of resources. And so going as a day student was an economical thing for me. I knew that it was a teacher's college, but I think I had an excellent education at Madison. I'm very proud of it, and was then fortunately able to get into the University of Virginia Law School after 3 years. So I have no undergraduate degree, because at that time there was no collaboration mm-hmm. between Madison College and the University of Virginia. If you wanted to do that, you would have gone to Mary Washington College. But economically, that was not going to be an option.
And so you decided, you mentioned maybe in high school, or you always wanted to be a lawyer.
Yes.
And you were interested in history, but why a lawyer? How did that, in the sense of you did not have people in your family, like you couldn't look at a grandparent maybe who was a lawyer or an uncle, and they were probably mostly men at that time. That's sort of a journey that you making a very serious commitment when I think you're saying that's my goal.
Well, I had some aspirations to be employed either at the FBI or the CIA. Now, I'm not quite sure why. And it was not until the end of my law school days that I realized that, one, at that time, being a woman and getting into the FBI was nearly impossible. Going to the CIA would likely mean that you'd be overseas mm-hmm. a lot, which didn't appeal to me. So I had to regroup my thinking and decided, well, then I guess I'll go into general practice. But I don't know how else I decided to go into law. Just wasn't going to be medicine. I didn't have an affinity for that. So perhaps that was the real option I had.
The real option. So tell me about law school.
Yes.
In 1959, 1960.
56 through 59.
Yeah.
Well, when my father and I went to UVA to the law school for an interview. And Professor Emerson Spees was the director of admissions at that time. And I had excellent grades, and I was a Virginia resident. And to this day, I believe that those two things were factors in my favor, because I was not particularly good at taking tests, so the LSAT did not go very well. But Professor Spees sat there and told us that they were going to admit me to the law school, but he didn't think that I would ever complete the course. So, of course, I was determined that I was going to be right and Professor Spees was going to be incorrect. And so when I entered law school, there were five women in the law school, and one of the other women was a day student coming out of, it was an older lady, and she came from Madison, I believe, Madison County. And the other two, three were from the New England area. And, but I was determined that I was going to be correct, and as it turned out, I was.
Well, you proved the professor incorrect.
I did.
Because you stayed.
I did.
Did you have any favorite classes in law school or favorite professors? Maybe somebody who served as a mentor for you during your law school education?
No, not during law school. One professor that I had while I was at Madison, I thought was particularly beneficial. And I might say that since I knew that I was only going to go to Madison for 3 years, I had the luxury of, except for certain required courses, I had the luxury of taking certain courses that I thought would be helpful or that appealed to me. And I took a lot of courses in the field of psychology and in the field of English writing. And one of the classes that I took there was called oral interpretation. And the professor for that was Dr. Latimer. And she was, as you can imagine, a theatrical professor. But she taught me an awful lot about how to interpret speech. And so I would put her in the category of someone that I admired and someone who influenced some of my work later on. In law school, frankly, I was so scared that I might fail that about all I did was study. And I was not at the top of the class, but I certainly managed to hold my own. I took some classes that today I laugh about, one of which was Admiralty. Here's somebody in the center of Virginia who has no intention of doing any law on the shore or near water, was taking Admiralty. I don't remember a thing about it, but I remember that I enjoyed it greatly.
So after you graduated, what did you do? Did you begin the work of private practice right away?
No. I clerked for the Circuit Court in Arlington for several years before I then went into private practice. And that was very beneficial at that time because it gave me the opportunity to meet and get to know just about all the lawyers in the Arlington, Fairfax, Alexandria area who would have cases in the Arlington Circuit Court. And so when I got ready to go into private practice, I already had what I will call an established relationship with them, which made the transition nice and easy and enjoyable. And I went to a two-person law firm at that time, and we did mostly insurance defense work there. I was a commissioner in chancery there for a number of years mm-hmm. that I was in Arlington, and that was very enjoyable.
Since, well, we still have, I guess, officially commissioners in chancery, but that's really sort of an old Virginia, I'll say, term of art. So explain what that involved when you did that kind of work.
Well, it's a quasi-judicial role, I would say. You're assigned cases, and there were chancery cases, obviously, which meant that they were heavily domestic relations cases. But you would also get cases which were partition of real estate. I remember one case that I had that went on for a very lengthy period of time involved an estate determining who the proper heirs of a particular estate were. And that took me to Middleburg and a number of people there. But so you take evidence mm-hmm. as you would if you were in court, and you apply the rules of evidence, and you have been given questions by the court when it issues the order mm-hmm. appointing you. And you take evidence to be able to answer those questions for the court and to make a recommendation if that's what is also requested. Mm-hmm. And I enjoyed that very much. I also was a commissioner when we moved to Loudoun for a short period of time.
And you mentioned we, and I haven't asked, so you were married?
Yes.
Where did you meet your husband? In law school?
No.
Or no?
I had a dental problem. And the secretary that I had at that time said, well, I have this wonderful dentist. Why don't you give him a call? So I did. And it turned out a couple of years later that he became my husband. So I've had good dental care for since 1967.
That is wonderful. I love this story. So you mentioned moving to Loudoun.
Yes.
And I know you were in practice in Arlington for a period of years.
Yes.
But you were in private practice in Loudoun for about 15 years.
Yes.
So again, primarily doing
family law, juvenile law, traffic law, a little criminal law. Not a great deal of real estate or estate work, but those were my primary interests in what
now,
I did.
Now, did you, early in your career, were you thinking then about the fact that you would want to be a judge?
Yes, absolutely. That was always a real goal. I guess I got into some politics, which sometimes you think could be helpful. In my case, it was both a help and a hindrance. But in any event, I always did. And the Commonwealth of Virginia at that time had and still has excellent benefits, and excellent benefits for judges. And so, ironically, in my thinking as well, some of the benefits that the Commonwealth of Virginia offered were enticing. Healthcare and retirement, and they're just unmatched. Even in my view, at that time at least, in the federal government, those benefits didn't match those of the Commonwealth of Virginia. So I was fortunate to be a substitute judge in Loudoun County, a judge then Carlton Penn. Appointed me, and so that was an excellent experience. And so I would sit Prince William, Loudoun, all around as a substitute judge. And I always have said that I think a very valuable piece of experience for the legislature when they want to appoint judges is if they have seen them as substitute judges, because that way they have a pretty good look at the kind of ability and temperament that a prospective candidate will bring to the full-time bench. So I was served in that capacity until 1986 then, when I was elected to the Juvenile and Domestic Relations District Court.
And how did you feel about that first judicial appointment?
As a substitute judge or this?
Well, no, and again, I'm even thinking that your service as the Commissioner in a Chancery is quasi-judicial,
yeah.
So that was a good preparation for then being a substitute judge. But once you got that first judicial appointment to the Juvenile and Domestic Relations District Court, were you excited?
Yes.
Anxious?
I was excited. I don't think I had too much anxiety. It was a very, well, the district included Loudoun, Fauquier, and Rappahannock counties. And I was going to sit primarily in Loudoun County, which I did. I rarely went to Fauquier or Rappahannock, although I did on occasion. But I think we only had about four people in the clerk's office at that time. It was a very small court. And so you might start at 9 or 10 o'clock, and sometimes you could be done a half an hour later. Now, that didn't continue as time went on.
Yeah.
But in the very beginning, I don't think I had any apprehension because, again, as a substitute judge, you have the opportunity to make that transition from being an advocate to being a decision maker, which I think is the most difficult thing for a lawyer to do.
Well, Well, that leads me nicely into the question in the sense of, do you think the type of work you did before you became a judge impacted your perception once you were a sitting judge, and how you made that adjustment between, again, advocate as a practicing attorney, and then decision maker as a judge who has those practicing attorneys before them in court?
Well, again, having been a substitute judge, I think I had mentally made that transition. And so when I became a full-time judge, I don't think that I had that learning curve. I think I'd already experienced that learning curve. And juvenile and domestic relations court was the kind of law at that time that I had primarily practiced. And so I was fully familiar with the law in the area and had wonderful staff and wonderful bailiffs. And so I'd had a lot of experience with them, both as a substitute judge and mm-hmm. as a practicing attorney. So it was an easy transition for me in that sense. I truly think that for some people who have not had some of that prior mm-hmm. experience, that mm-hmm. making that transition is one of the most difficult things they have to do when they're appointed to the bench.
I know from a conversation with Justice Kuntz, Justice Lawrence
yes.
Kuntz from the Supreme Court of Virginia,
right.
he mentioned that kind of, in terms of comparing the various benches on which he has sat, mm-hmm. that might have been in some sense the most difficult because of the nature of the cases. Did you find that difficult in the sense that we're dealing with families and children, wonderful occasions like adoptions, but also serious occasions,
yep.
Divorce and child custody matters?
Well, the juvenile court at that time, of course, did not have divorce jurisdiction. That was in the circuit court. Although we had the family court, I'm digressing on you, we had the family court pilot project in Virginia. Professor Rob Shepard, mm-hmm. I'm sure you knew him, mm-hmm. Was a big promoter of trying to get the General Assembly to approve that. They approved the pilot project. May I digress on this because
yes,
it's
ma'am.
Really exciting.
Yes, ma'am.
And Rob Baldwin was the secretary to the Supreme Court at that time, executive secretary, and we were not in the original selected group, and I very much wanted to be in the pilot project. And so I got our circuit judges to agree to let me solicit Rob Baldwin to take Loudoun County in as a rural jurisdiction. At that time, we had, I think, one or two stoplights in the whole county. We had 347 miles of unpaved roads in Loudoun County. And the court service unit director and I gathered all these statistics, our caseload, just all the statistics that we needed. And we persuaded Rob Baldwin to take us in, and they did, as a rural jurisdiction. So at that point, we did get some divorce okay. cases during that 2 years. Then going back to your question, I spent 12 years in the juvenile court, and they were 12 wonderful years, and I really enjoyed it. And to me, the significant thing was I felt in the juvenile court is the one place, the one court, where you have an opportunity to really make a difference in someone's life. When you get to the circuit court, and I spent 2 years subsequently there, my philosophy is you decide the facts, you apply the law, and if you happen to make a difference in someone's life, it's an accident. So the juvenile court is just really important. And yes, you have hard cases, but when you see those successes, particularly in the young people, it is awe-inspiring. And I think we had a lot of successes. I think we did. And I'm excited about that. And I can tell you some funny stories related to that.
Please do.
Since we were in a rural jurisdiction and we lived on a farm out in western Loudoun, And we had a family that had several children. And the children, not everyone, but most of them, were in and out of the court. And they didn't do anything too terribly bad. But there was the one little boy, and I'll just call him X because I don't want to give his name. Anyway, I was going to court one morning, and I drove out of Percy Hill, got up on Route 7, and here was this young fella out there hitchhiking. And I recognized him. It was X. And I pulled over, and I said, X, get in the car. I'm going to drive you down to court because I don't want you to be late. And I did. And it was that kind of thing. I put one young fella in jail for, I think, not paying support to his wife or something. And the next thing you know, he got to spend his 10 days in jail. And next week or two, I saw him in the Safeway. Hi, Judge. How are you doing? Hi, Mr. So-and-so. I'm fine. How are you? I'm fine. Thank you. So, you know, we had that kind of circumstance in Loudoun County. And that also made it enjoyable.
It was a sense of community, and you were very much a part of that.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Very much. My husband had a dental practice in Purcellville at that time. And of course, you know, between the people that I had contact with and the people that he had contact with, and we just knew a whole lot of people, and it was very exciting. But if I go back to Loudoun, which I did the other week, you get lost, and I got lost.
And there's probably far more paved roads than there were back when the pilot court was implemented.
Yeah.
So by 1998, you were elected to serve as a judge of the 20th Circuit.
Yes.
And again, you mentioned that includes Loudoun, Fauquier, and Rappahannock counties. You were the first woman to serve in that circuit, in that position.
Yes.
How did you feel about that? I mean, did you realize the significance of that at the time? Maybe not?
No, I realized that I was the first woman elected. But of course, I knew all the people. I knew Judge Horn, I knew Judge Shamblin. Judge Penn was still there in a semi-retired capacity. Judge Robertson was sitting primarily in Warrenton. I knew all these folks. And so I didn't have any difficulty. I don't think they had any difficulty. We just blended quite well together.
Okay. Did you have any, after, you know, you were on the bench and you're working, and you mentioned some of these judges' names that I've heard before, did you have any judicial heroes or models or mentors that maybe formally or maybe informally that you looked to provide guidance?
No.
No?
No, I didn't.
On your own trainings and your instincts about what...
I would say so, yes.
So, again, thinking back to these different kinds of courts, how different was your time as a judge in terms of your day-to-day operation when you were in the Juvenile and Domestic Relations Court versus maybe the Circuit Court? I know, obviously, the nature of the cases are different, but, you know, in Circuit Court, you may have jury trials.
Yes.
You're not going to have those in J&D. How were your days different in terms of how you spent your time as a judge?
Well, as I said, Loudoun was a relatively small county in those earlier days, and even up through till the latter part of my time in the Circuit Court. And so in the Juvenile Court, you could finish your docket in a half hour or maybe an hour or two. And I know the judges before me would leave, and I didn't do that. I stayed in chambers. If I had done all the work, then I might have brought a magazine to read or something. But I felt that if someone came with a pleading or a motion that required my attention, or if the clerks had an issue that required my attention, then it was my responsibility to be there. In the Circuit Court, we didn't have days that ended in a half an hour or an hour or 2 hours, unless a case settled or a defendant would enter a plea agreement. But even if that happened, there were office matters mm-hmm. to be attended to. There were orders to be signed and things of that nature. And so the days were all complete days, I would say. And of course, mm-hmm. if you had a jury trial, you could either determine to stop at 5 o'clock and come back on another day, or you could decide based on input from the jurors and the other persons, whether or not you wanted to stay on and finish it that evening. So in that sense, it was very different. And of course, the cases were vastly different. They were much more different in terms of the kinds of cases that the court would mm-hmm. receive. And they were different in terms of the lawyering and the rules of evidence and the rules of discovery. Discovery just began to overwhelm the civil cases, in my view. But it was different in that way.
So how about your staff? Again, you've mentioned, you know, having established relationships with staff, and that was a good thing. Mm-hmm. So how do you feel like your relationships were with your staff? I guess particularly as a circuit court judge, did the court at that time have judicial law clerks? Did you have a law clerk either you shared with somebody or someone was assigned specifically to you?
We had no law clerks in the juvenile court, of course.
Yeah.
My relationship with that staff was just excellent. I had just a wonderful staff, and I'm sure they would agree if I can say so. The circuit court, the clerks there, I also had a wonderful relationship with, and we had law clerks. Okay. My memory is at that time that they were not individually assigned to us, that we had at least two that I recall, and we shared those law clerks. But one of them, when I was elected to the Court of Appeals, I asked him to go with me, and he did. But that's how we had the staff. And my relationship with the staff in the juvenile court was probably closer because we were a smaller group. Mm-hmm. But the circuit court had a director of the jury and the scheduling and several people that I knew personally and that were just wonderful. Yeah. Again, and part of the reason for that, I think, was because we were a relatively small county at that time.
And so you served on the 20th Circuit
yeah.
from 1998 to 2000.
Right.
And in 2000, then you were elected by the General Assembly to an 8-year term on the Virginia Court of Appeals.
Right.
And the Court of Appeals had been in operation for a while at that point. They were kind of established. How did that change your work as a judge? Let's say compared to J&DR Court, Circuit Court, and now we're on the Court of Appeals.
Yes, the Court of Appeals was established, I believe, in 1986. And it was an entirely different court, as you say. Because we don't take evidence. We decide cases on the basis of the record. And so that was different. I had an independent office in Leesburg, and I had an administrative person and one law clerk. And as I said, I took both of them from the circuit court with me. The administrative person had been in the clerk's office, mm-hmm. and the law clerk had been one of the circuit court law clerks, and he stayed with me the entire time. And I always said that I had the second best law clerk on the court. The first one was Stephanie Payne, who'd been with the court for a long, long time.
And still is.
Still
with
is
the court.
With the court, absolutely. In fact, I saw Stephanie as I came in today. But it's an entirely different mode of judging. It's on the record. And again, it's a bit of a transition, and I will say that it was a bit of a transition. But again, I had Bill McIntyre, who was an excellent a writer, to assist me, and it went smoothly, I think.
I guess I would note that, so for appellate cases, you have the attorneys come for the oral argument, right, or the Court of Appeals was sitting in panels, so for your panel of three, but there's not the interaction. You no longer have the interaction with the parties.
True.
Like you do in the circuit court, or particularly the J&DR district court. Did you miss that, having that interaction with more people? Or perhaps at that point in your life, you were, it was time to make that transition where you might spend more time, again, as you said, with the record, as opposed to the attorneys?
I was ready to make that transition. And I believe that I can function in either kind of environment. And it's true, our office for those 8 years was my administrative person and my law clerk. And I said, if you came to our office, you were either lost or you were the UPS driver, because nobody ever came. And so we had to be a cohesive group with the three of us, which we were. Now, later on, we also got two additional law clerk personnel, but still, we were just our own group. And the only time that you would see the other judges would be if you happened to be sitting with them on a panel. And I don't know if it's in the statute, I doubt if it's in the statute, but it certainly is in our policy and procedure manual that the active judges sit at least one time a year with each other active judge, and that at that time that we sit at least one time in each of our jurisdictions, which at that time, Richmond, Salem, Alexandria, and Chesapeake. Now, we've changed that a little bit, and we've allowed it to be broadened, and I think that's a good thing. But so we would get to see one another, or if we sat on bank, obviously, then we'd have everybody together in Richmond. So it would take a little while to really get to know the other members of the court, because you didn't see them except once a month, or maybe once every 6 months, or when you had on bank, which might have been once every 3 months. So that was a change, and it took a while to get to know all of the other members of the court, because I don't think I knew any of them individually before being elected to the court.
One of the questions we usually ask is, you know, how you choose your law clerks, or did you have a longtime judicial assistant or law clerks? And you've already shared with us, your clerk and the judicial assistant came with you from the circuit court and then were with you for a number of years.
Yes, the law clerk was there the entire time. The administrative law clerk was probably there. Well, originally they were called administrative assistant, I think, and I decided that we should call him administrative law clerk, although the original person was just simply secretarial. But when she left, thereafter, I always hired attorneys to that position. And I think a lot of judges do that rather than having strictly what I'll call a secretarial type person, because with everything computerized the way it is now, you basically don't need that individual skill. You need the skill that also involves legal training. It could be a paralegal as well. But so I had the fortune of having one law clerk the whole time, but I did hire over the course of my time as an active judge, other personnel to the office, and one or two of them were excellent and one or two of them not so excellent.
Not so much. So what qualities did you look for in somebody like that, in a law clerk?
Somebody with writing skills, because that's obviously the bulk of what we do. We write. And other than that, just someone who would be compatible with the staff that we had, and someone who would be capable of working almost in isolation. Just as I said, nobody came into our office unless it was by accident or the UPS guy. So if you are a person who is really people-oriented and you're used to being around people all day, you may or may not find being a law clerk in that kind of circumstance suitable for you. But the writing skills were the most important. And I remember one time I was considering hiring one law clerk, and our then chief staff attorney, John Tucker, had a recommendation for her. And I remember the phrase he used. He said, "You will not be disappointed if you hire her." And I thought that was just an excellent way of describing someone that you'd want to hire. And someone who would be willing to challenge me. In other words, you know, you're going to do some research for me and you're going to give me an opinion, but I want to know your legal opinion. And if I have some hesitancy or pushback, if you want to stand your ground, don't be afraid to stand your ground and tell me that you think my thinking is incorrect. You know, that's important.
And did that occur?
On occasion it did. And sometimes my thinking about something as I would go into oral argument turned out to be dead wrong. And so sometimes the law clerk would have been dead right.
But you're talking about writing, and clearly an important skill. What was your process for writing your decisions? Did it change over time?
What was my what?
Your process, in the sense process. Of how did you approach, okay, so you attend a panel, oral argument. You've already got the briefs and the appendices that accompany that. You know, you've read those. And so in your mind, you're already thinking about how you're going to work on this. When you were going to write an opinion, where did you start? Did you already have, kind of an outline in your mind of where you were going to go with the opinion? Did you do some research and then maybe make the outline, or you were and or the law clerk? How did you approach that in the sense the final product has to be an opinion?
Yes.
So how did we get from this pile of information to this opinion that you've authored?
Well, in those days you would get large boxes delivered by the UPS man, which of course no longer occurs. It all comes in huge volumes on the computer. You get a case, and you know absolutely nothing about it when you get it. And I can tell you now, or I can tell you the way it was then.
But I want to hear about both.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, obviously, the law clerk that I had as an active judge would be I had three at one time. I would assign the case to one of those three. Now, the chief staff attorney's office provides law clerks for the senior judges, and so Alice Armstrong, our chief, will assign a particular staff attorney mm-hmm. To a given judge on a given case on a given mm-hmm. panel.
Okay,
so we start there, and the law clerk will do research, and I will do research. And as you do research, you start thinking, well, you know, this sounds like it was error, and maybe should be reversed, or this looks like it's probably not an error and will be affirmed. And so you do all of your research, and in doing your research, you formulate questions that you want to ask at the oral argument, because most cases have questions that need to be mm-hmm. asked mm-hmm. and be answered. But you can obviously come to some tentative thinking, well, this case is likely to be affirmed, or this case is likely to be reversed. And the law clerk is doing research, and they're also going through the same process. And so you talk about it back and forth. And so you see who's thinking this way and why. And I usually like to have the facts of the case developed in written form.
Okay.
Because the facts are not going to change. The facts are going to be clearly there from the record. Mm-hmm. But what you do with the issues, of course, is the ultimate issue. And so they will give me their research, And sometimes it will seem like it's going to be very clear, and sometimes it will seem like it's going to be really completely unclear. And you have the oral argument. And it is not until after the oral argument that a decision is made in case. And I always think that that's something that the public really should understand. You can have a thought about it, but that oral argument is very significant. And I also think that it's a very unwise idea for an attorney to waive oral argument. Because I have had cases, maybe not too many, but I've had cases in which my thought about how something is likely to be concluded is dead wrong. And the oral argument has made a big difference. But the three judges get together, and a judge is assigned the case. The judge takes the lead in explaining the case and what his or her thinking may be. The other two judges are asked their view. Sometimes we all three agree, in which case it's go home and draft an opinion. And sometimes it can be, I don't agree with that at all, in which case you know that maybe you're going to be doing a lead opinion and you're going to get a dissent. Or you can say, well, I don't know. I'll take a look at that when you send it to me. I'll take a look at it when you put it in writing, because that's another interesting thing. Sometimes you think a case is going to go one way, and when you sit down to write it, you can't get it to go that way. I mean, it just won't go that way. All right? It won't go that way. Then it has to go the correct way. And so I don't know if anybody's gone through that process with you before, but that's my way.
No, that's, I think that's very interesting, and it's very important, I think, for people to understand how that process works, and you've shared
and
that.
And they always ask that, you know, when you go to the seminars for the lawyers, they want to know, how do you decide this? How do you decide that? You know, what's the process? And we try to tell them what the process is, and they keep asking the question, and that's fine.
Maybe... it's good that they keep asking, but it, perhaps if they actually followed the information that was shared, that would be even better.
That'd be better.
So were there instances where you had to reconcile a case that the law was here, but maybe you felt personally in a different way? For me, I could see where that might happen, where I know a statute or previous cases say this, which would lead me to this outcome, but in my heart of hearts, I feel very differently about how I think this outcome should be. Did that ever happen for you? And if it did, how did you kind of work that out?
You know, that's always a question, certainly, that I was asked, and probably every judicial candidate is asked by the General Assembly. When they're considering a candidate, because we are all human, and we all have backgrounds that we bring to a candidacy. For me, it was a very easy thing to say and to be one who, my personal views are my personal views, have absolutely nothing to do with the case. And so we have had cases in which, I mean, they would always ask, the General Assembly would always say, well, how do you feel about capital punishment, for instance? And I would say, my personal view on that is irrelevant. As long as I can ignore that, if I get a case in which that kind of topic requires a judicial decision. I'm at my retirement, one of the judges said, one thing about me, he said, Judge Clements has not come to the court with an agenda. And I guess I would describe it that way. My personal views are my personal views, and I have no difficulty in setting those aside on any of those difficult cases. And I've had them mostly in the area of domestic relations, because we did not have, obviously, a death penalty jurisdiction in the Court of Appeals. But I've had no difficulty doing that. And I am one who firmly believes that if we have established law, mm-hmm. stare decisis suggests that mm-hmm. that is what binds me. Mm-hmm. And so I come from that philosophy.
Did you have any cases that you felt were really significant that you decided while you were actively on the Court of Appeals?
Well, we had some issues regarding custody out of civil marriages that probably legally required the most challenge, because there really was very little law at the time we were mm-hmm. being confronted with some of those. So they had to be worked through. But I would say that probably was the only kind of case that I ever mm-hmm. Was involved in or have been involved in that was sort of groundbreaking, if you will.
So now you're currently serving and have been serving as a senior judge on the Court of Appeals. How did your role change, or I'm assuming, and you've already explained the difference now that you're using a law clerk that the Chief Staff Attorney's Office right. provides for you. But other than that, how did your role change when you made that transition from actively sitting on the Court of Appeals to now serving as a senior judge?
Well, the biggest difference is you no longer have a vote on the policy decisions of the court. That's the biggest change. Another change is, of course, you don't sit on bank. So if you're on a panel and you have authored an opinion mm-hmm. and one of the attorneys asks for the case to go on bank and the court votes to hear it on bank, you do not have a say because I do not sit on bank. So I had one of those last year, and I told the other judges, I had a dissenting judge in the case, and so the other judge who was on my affirmance end of the case, I said, you have to defend me in this case because I can't defend myself. So that's one of the biggest differences. And of course you don't have your own standalone office. My so-called office is in my computer room in my home. I have a little cubbyhole that has my printer and my computer and that's my Court of Appeals office. So we don't have a standalone office and we don't have a staff. Mm-hmm. So we have to rely upon the Chief Staff Attorney to provide mm-hmm. us legal assistance and help draft opinions in our cases. So those are the biggest differences.
Well, and that would be different too, because you're using the services of someone who's here in Richmond.
Yep.
And you're somewhere else,
yes.
your home office.
Yes.
And so you're this kind of communication and this conversation, even if it's by way of phone, it's remote.
Yes.
Correct?
Yes,
so you've kind of lost some of that, I guess, connection
yes,
with having
you
the
have.
Person.
And I know several of the staff attorneys who are still there from my time as an active judge. But of course, the legislature expanded our jurisdiction 2 years ago, so now we have 17 active judges. I don't know how many increases in the clerk's office and how many increases in the staff attorney's office, but we have many clerks now in the clerk's office and many staff attorneys in the staff attorney's office that I have never met. And they're working with me on my cases, or they're communicating with me about, well, how are we going to schedule this on this docket? So those are big changes. And I do miss that, because when I used to come to court here, I would always make the rounds. I would go say hello to the clerks, and I would go say hello to the staff attorneys. I discovered not long ago that the staff attorneys aren't even in this building anymore. It's expanded so much that they've moved them to another building elsewhere, so I don't even see them at all. So those are big changes.
Yeah.
And of course, the court's gone from now the number that when I was active to 17.
11 to 17.
And the jurisdiction has changed dramatically. We've gotten most of the Supreme Court's work, and so it's made a big difference.
And the court's very busy, too.
Very busy.
So do you have any observations about maybe over time how the, I mean, we know, and you just mentioned how the legislation that had occurred changed the jurisdiction of the court, and of course the court in terms of number of judges on the court has increased from 11 to 17. Beyond that though, are, do you have any observations about how the Court of Appeals has maybe changed over time? Because we're thinking if you were appointed in, or elected in 2000, it's been 24 years. Any thoughts about that? What's the court, I guess maybe dynamics of the court, or, I mean, the mission is the same.
Mission's the same. Well, the dynamic has changed because the numbers have changed. And the more you get, the more difficult it is to have a closer relationship. That's just human nature. I'm sitting tomorrow, and I'm sitting with one of our judges that I've never met. And he's been on the court now for several years. It's very different. It's very different. And the caseload is just so different. The caseload reminds me more of what we used to have when I was in the circuit court. We're getting so many civil cases of the kind that we never had before. We had workers' compensation and administrative law cases before, but they were relatively controlled numbers. But now we're getting all kinds of civil cases. And so it takes a lot more learning because I haven't done some of those areas ever, and some of those areas in how many years? Since 1986. And so partition cases or debt new cases or things of that nature. So it does take a lot more learning. And for me, it takes a lot more listening, both to the law clerks and also to the other judges. And we apparently are hiring law clerks now with some diversity of experience, not just criminal experience or domestic experience or workers' compensation experience, but also with civil experience. Actual innocence and pro se. So we're bringing in other law clerks that have some experience in some of these other areas to add to the experience that already exists.
Another question I had was, how did the expansion of the Court of Appeals impact you and your work? And you've made it very clear in terms of that.
It has.
Has changed, requires maybe in some sense, some sort of basic research or basic understanding of an area you might not have dealt with before, where prior to that expansion, you were
very
probably
familiar.
Very familiar with the statutes and the resources that would cover, domestic relations, criminal matters, administrative law.
Yes.
And so again, if now you're looking at wills or, as you said, or real property cases, that might require one to go back and kind of refresh their memory about those areas
Absolutely.
Of law.
Absolutely.
So Judge Clements, would be characteristics of a good judge?
Well, a good judge has to be a good listener. Now, these are not necessarily in the order in which I would put them if I thought about it for a long time. Has to be a good listener. Has to be a person who is willing to consider the views of the other judges in a multi-court circumstance. Has to be, in my view, true to the law. And by that I mean to say, recognize that we have been a country since, 1789, when we adopted our Constitution. We have been developing law in this country since that time, and we have principles that are there, which are the law that exists, and be faithful to it, whether we personally agree with it or not. And I think that's so important. And if someone has an agenda and they decide that they don't like something that's gone on and they want to make changes to it and they're willing to set aside everything that's gone before, to me is a dangerous thing for the judicial system. And I respect the judicial system, and I respect every court in it, state court, federal court, up to our U.S. Supreme Court. And but I say that because I personally have a strong feeling about that.
Thank you. I feel like I would be remiss if I did not ask. I know when you when you retired from the Court of Appeals, and then before you became a senior judge on the Court of Appeals, the legislature passed a House Joint Resolution, and they provided a lot of information about your background, but they also mentioned that in your retirement, and now I'm wondering with the Court of Appeals and the change in the caseload, it might not afford you as much time as you may have had to do some of these things, but it mentioned that you and you had other interests, including bird photography, stamp collecting, genealogy, and I want to know if you are taking piano lessons.
No, I am not. I was for the longest kind of time, but I have some vision issues which make playing the piano difficult. And so my baby grand piano is sitting there not being utilized by me at the moment, but I do still have all the other hobbies. And I think that that is an important thing for someone, anyone who is going to finish in the workplace full time and consider retiring, that they need to have interests and they need to have hobbies. I know over the years I've heard people say, oh, I'm looking forward to retirement because I love gardening and I love traveling. And I think to myself, well, let's see, you can garden maybe 4 or 5 months of the year. If you can afford it, you might be able to travel once or twice a year. Now, what are you going to do the rest of the time? And so I think it's very important that we have hobbies and interests that keep us going. And I am an avid stamp collector. I collect United States stamps and have since I was...
I was going to ask, did these hobbies begin in childhood, or you maybe...
Developed them?
Developed them over the years.
I collected stamps as a child. I lived on South Royal Avenue in Front Royal, which was one of the main streets. And on the street behind us, Lee Street, was a disabled lady, Laura Virginia Hale. And she was a stamp collector. I mean, she had an excellent collection. And I would go with my quarter or dollar or whatever I had, and I would go through the back alley over to Laura Virginia Hale's every now and then with my book. And I would sit down and she would get out her duplicates. And I would pick duplicates and I would give her whatever, nickel, dime, whatever. And so that started my interest in stamp collecting. And I have done that ever since. Sometimes it's been a number of years go by when I haven't been very active at it, but I have it up to date and in good condition, although nobody else in my family seems to really have any interest in it in the event that I need to dispose of it, which is a sad thing. But that is an interest that I have. I still do bird photography. I do. Not quite as well as I did at one point. We've done a lot of traveling, my husband and I, around the world, and we enjoy doing that.
Do you have a favorite place you like to visit?
I don't like to go back to a place because I'm always thinking that it won't be the way that I enjoyed it the first time. It will change.
So there's always a new place.
There's always a new place.
So where would you like to go next?
I've wanted to go to Antarctica. And I really explored that for this year. In fact, for this period of time. But my husband's never been very enthusiastic about Antarctica. Although this year, on my birthday, he said, as part of your birthday present, I'll agree to go to Antarctica. But I had some back surgery in December, and that took away all the pain. But now I'm trying to deal with some mobility issues, so I didn't decide to go to Antarctica this year. But that's always been the last one place that I really wanted to go. We've gone to some wonderful places around the world that I've enjoyed. So one of my favorites, I guess my all-time favorite, was a horseback trip that we took in the Okavango Delta in Botswana, 10-day trip.
On horseback?
On horseback, yeah, camping and on horseback. And then one of my second favorite trips would have been to the Galapagos. And then right before the pandemic hit in 2019, we went to the Pantanal in Brazil to see the jaguar in the wild, which we did. So, you know, but anyway, until I overcome my mobility issues from this back surgery, we haven't planned any major trips this year. So, but we have these interests, and my husband has many interests and hobbies too. And
does he also enjoy the bird photography?
No.
Or he likes being with you maybe while you take the pictures? He likes to travel.
He likes to travel, and he's got his own little camera. He takes pictures sometimes better than mine, actually. But he's a beef cattle farmer, and he rides and competes in dressage. And in fact, he just celebrated his 90th birthday on the 29th of September. I had a huge birthday celebration, and he rode his horse and did a third level musical freestyle, and he is still competing. And so
he's still competing.
Still competing. Yeah, the shows are over for the year, but he's got his eye on next year. So yeah, and he's got his beef cattle. He's transitioning from Black Angus to Red Angus, and so
You have your hands full.
We have plenty that's going on all the time.
Going on.
Yeah. But that's important. I think that's really important, you know, for anybody who's thinking about retiring, that you have to have some interests and hobbies.
So before we wrap up today, yeah. And I do appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule to talk with us. Is there anything else you want to share about your time as a judge on the Court of Appeals, or just generally having been a legal professional in Virginia since the, let's say, mid-50s to now?
You have probably covered all of the subjects. I love Virginia. I wouldn't want to live anywhere other than Virginia. In terms of climate, in terms of opportunity, and I think the world of the Virginia judiciary. It was the goal of a lifetime, and I was fortunate enough to achieve it. And so I've enjoyed my life, and it's been very good for me. And some people say, well, Mom, or whatever they call me, when are we going to have a birthday celebration for you? I had 117 people that attended this celebration that I put on for him. When are we going to do that for you? And I said, you know, I have been honored in my lifetime. I don't need anything more special to go on. It's been a wonderful life, and I have no regrets about it at all.
Thank you again so much.
Thank you.
Judge Clements.
I have enjoyed meeting you. I've certainly dealt with you on many occasions, and you provided wonderful service to the
Thank
Commonwealth,
you.
And I was very sad when I heard you were going to retire. So it's been my great pleasure to meet you and to have this opportunity to talk with you.
Thank you.
Thank you.